This public radio podcast is supported by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness. Online at loveandforgive.org.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Well, today it's Thomas Jefferson, the first American to make a serious study of wine. And true to form, it wasn't enough to drink it. Jefferson toured vineyards. He collected wines from places barely known by his countrymen, and he made wine himself. Our guest, John Hailman, has the story. His book is Jefferson on Wine. Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins, another man who has traveled far beyond the ordinary, is back with new finds to get us out of our cheese ruts. We have the story of a new husband's ill-fated attempt to bring his wife breakfast in bed. I take on yet another challenger in our refrigerator game, Stump the Cook. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, you may or may not remember that I absolutely hate fish.
Well, I remember this vividly, Jane.
Okay, good. Yes, then I've made an impression on you over the years. I found a place where I actually like fish, and it's at Sam's Grill in San Francisco, where I ordered an enormous plate of Rex sole, and it was without a doubt the most delicious thing I've ever eaten.
What inspired this, Jane? Because
I made her order it.
Michael inspired Jane.
You can't go to Sam's and not eat the great seafood. I should say parenthetically, there's a whole menu of other really appetizing sounding stuff. You know, charcoal broiled steaks, and they have mock turtle soup, for heaven's sake.
Abalone in butter sauce.
Oh, my. Well, this sounds like old California kind of stuff.
This is old California. In fact, Sam's has been around since 1867. This particular building is more recent than that. But nonetheless, when you go in, it really looks like an old San Francisco restaurant. You know, the brass coat hooks, the thick white linen on the tables. And it's got that terrific blend of, I don't want to call it formality, but just good manners and casualness. I have to say, the prices are not cheap here. This is not a typical road food dive. This is a pretty fancy restaurant, but you're welcome there if you're well-behaved. You don't have to dress up the part, although a lot of people there are dressed in pinstripes.
And if you're not well-behaved, they have another thing that I am just such a sucker for.
What is that?
Which is private dining booths with a curtain, you know, and a little buzzer for the waiter. So, you know, if you plan on, I don't know, eating in your underpants or something, I guess you can do it at a private wooden dining booth.
I want to break this too gently. Maybe people use those booths to just be alone together, fully clothed, perhaps.
If I may make a confession, though, I have to say Jane and I get extremely poorly behaved in this restaurant in the sense that we steal things from it.
We do?
At the beginning of the meal, you get a big round of sourdough bread.
Oh, you're right.
And I have to say, this is maybe the best sourdough bread I've ever had. I mean, real sour, real chewy, with that hard crust. I mean, it's quintessential San Francisco sourdough bread. And I have to admit that once or twice at Sam's, we have pocketed like maybe a quarter loaf for later.
I put the entire round loaf because we were dining with two other people. So we got a whole round loaf. I put it in my purse and then looked very sad when the waiter came by and asked for some more. But you're right. We did steal.
What part of the city is this in?
It's in the financial district, so I'm told. I don't know San Francisco all that well, but as I said, it's frequented by a lot of important-looking business types. Mm. But we walked in jeans and, you know, casual shirts and were treated just like the fancy people.
Lynn, do you know what goes in mock turtle soup?
You know, I probably did in another life, but I'm completely clueless at this moment.
I'm assuming it's chicken.
I think maybe, but I haven't seen that. That's the kind of thing that would have been on the menu for our grandparents.
Well, they've got it here. They've got Hangtown Fry, which is that old, you know, scrambled egg and oyster dish.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow.
That is typical of San Francisco. They've even got some dishes. I have no idea what is chicken Elizabeth or prawns Dory. I mean, someday we're going to go to Sam's
and try
those.
I really wanted short ribs of beef with horseradish
sauce.
That's
also on the menu, yes.
It's just, you know, it's the kind of a grill that truly you only find in San Francisco, which is historic and venerable and also casual at the same time. I think for some reason only Northern Californians can pull that off correctly.
Well, it does sound like that. It does sound like you're walking back in time. It also sounds delicious.
It is. Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Chayne and Michael Stern are authors of Two for the Road. Now, you know the Sterns check in here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, I don't know what it is lately, but it seems every time I turn on the TV, there's something about enhanced drinks, drinks that improve our performance. This is getting very bizarre. Have you heard about the drink with the label that instructs you to have only half the can the first few times? I mean, as though the kids who are drawn to these kinds of drinks are going to do that. Now, the reason that this drink was in the news was one of its, quote, enhancements. It's an herb that has the possible side effects of renal failure and death. Well, now, herbal always sounds so benign. 7-Eleven stores now have announced that they're going to be adding herbal enhancements to their coffee, which brings to mind all the caffeine in some of these enhanced drinks. So here's my question. What is so wrong with us that we need enhancement? I mean, every time I look at those shelves of drinks, it's as though they're pointing a finger at me and they're saying, you're not awake enough. You're not peaceful enough. You're not strong enough. You're not smart enough. I am going to stick to water, plain old dumb water. Steve Jenkins is constantly hunting down exceptional cheeses. I mean, before terms like artisan and raw milk were being tossed around, Steve was combing Europe and America for these cheeses. He's the author of Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer and a regular visitor to the Splendid Table. Hey, Steve, it's good to have you back.
Great to be back.
Steven, you get in this real rut when you buy cheese. I think most of us do. You tend to keep doing the same thing again and again. Any thoughts about how to get out of that?
I can't believe you brought that up because I've been thinking about it so much lately. I've been working the counter, and I see people come in and buy the same thing over and over and over, and I do that too.
There's,
there's probably six or eight cheeses that I constantly serve when I'm with our best friends. You know, it's the same old friends, and it's always the same old cheeses. But, you know, I know so much about it, the cheeses that I choose drop dead. But so many people that come into the store and confronted with 350, 400 cheeses, and it's daunting. So they buy the same old thing over and over and over. And I thought to myself, Lynn would be interested to hear some options.
Lynn is hanging on your every word, Steve.
As usual.
So give us some breakout cheeses.
Well, it seems to me like four out of five people that come to the counter ask for Manchego. And I go immediately into this rap where, you know, I've got a lot of respect for Manchego, the great sheep's milk cheese that comes from La Mancha, that sprawling area above, around, and below Madrid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's satisfying and it's workmanlike and it's a good foil for lots of other things that you can serve. But people don't seem to understand that there are so many better sheep cheeses in the world, and certainly in Spain, than Manchego. And I mean, I'm talking Roncal, for instance, R-O-N-C-A-L. Now, that's a sheep's cheese that comes from Navarra. Same recipe as Manchego, same shape of a cheese. But the milk that comes out of Navarra is, in my opinion, superior to any of the sheep's milk that comes out of Castilla-La Mancha or Castilla-León. It's a richer, more lingering flavor. It's got a better mouthfeel to it as opposed to the granularness that you get from Manchego.
Mm-hmm.
Roncal was awarded the first denomination of origin of any cheese in Spain. Manchego came way, way after. It's just that we're so inured as being fans of Madrid, and all the Madrileños eat nothing but Manchego. So many Madrileños don't even know that Roncal exists. Roncal is more important than Manchego. It's a better buy, and it is a better cheese. And that goes for Castellano, which comes from Castilla-León. That also goes for Zamorano, that comes from Castilla-León. Get away from Manchego. Taste these other Spanish cheeses. And by all means, don't forget that where that fabulous range of mountains of the Pyrenees goes across and separates the Iberian Peninsula from France, there is a host of sheep's milk cheeses on the French side that are among the greatest cheeses in the universe.
What about the blue cheese fiend who always buys maybe either Stilton or Roquefort because they're safe? We know what those cheeses are. How about taking us down that path?
There's been an explosion of blue cheeses in the last 10 years from all over Europe and certainly from all over the United States. And I want people to get out of that rut of always buying Roquefort. Though I just had a fabulous experience with Roquefort last month. In fact, I'm wearing a Roquefort smock as we speak from my friend Jacques Carl, the great Roquefort maker. But that smoky blue from Oregon that's smoked with Oregon hazelnut shells is brilliant. We've got the Bingham Hill Blue from Massachusetts. We've got the Great Hills Blue from Massachusetts. There are so many grand blues for you to choose from. The Saint-Agur from southwest France. The great Forma d'Ambert from the Auvergne region in the very center of France. Mm-hmm. There's so many better choices than the same old Stilton and Gorgonzola, though I adore Gorgonzola.
Yeah.
There are some choices you can make that will really, really bring you some joy.
In the cheddar department, that's my thing. I mean, I adore cheddars, and I think I always tend to think they're overlooked. But again, I end up getting in a rut too with that.
Absolutely, and it's only because you buy what's offered to you, and what's offered to you is usually supermarket commodity cheddar that is completely not memorable, or Cabot cheddar from Vermont, which is certainly decent, but it's made by the megaton, and it's made from pasteurized milk. It's such a better choice to say, I want the Grafton cheddar from Vermont. I want the Fiscalini cheddars that come from California. Mario Gonzalez is the cheesemaker at Fiscalini. He used to be at Shelburne, but he moved out there about 8 years ago, and he's won every award in the industry. So I want you to opt for the Grafton cheddar from Vermont or the Fiscalini from California, or by all means, ask them if they have any of the farmhouse English Somerset cheddars from England, specifically the Montgomery or the Keynes. They're brilliant. They have layers of flavor, unlike so much American cheddar that is so one-dimensional.
Okay. I have now been taken out of my rut, and I greatly appreciate it. Hey, thank you,
sir.
That's
what we're here for.
I'm so glad. Steve Jenkins can be found behind the cheese counter at New York City's Fairway Markets, but you can find his cheese picks on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, be sure to register for our brand new limited-run e-newsletter and information on its accompanying podcast. They're both called How to Eat Supper, and they're based on our brand new book of the same name. Now, every week for a limited time, we send you a new recipe from the book, and we've put together even more tips and information relating to that week's topic on the How to Eat Supper podcast. And best of all, they're both free. So register online, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Sipping the Grape with Thomas Jefferson, Love and Breakfast in Bed, and Stump the Cook. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Jefferson has been lionized, criticized, and cited for his Renaissance mentality so many times in ways that you lose count. He was so typical of the wealthy and educated 18th century gentleman scholar, except that his curiosity and his need to control took him deeper and wider than most, especially when it came to wine. Few Americans of his day explored wine the way Jefferson did, and even fewer kept notes. Wine writer John Hillman has spent 30 years with Jefferson's writings. His book is a guide to those notes, Jefferson on Wine. John, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. Good to be here.
Now, John, you spent 30 years with Jefferson and his papers. Now, what is so important about Jefferson and wine?
Well, I might say it was time well spent. Wine was a big part of his life, and I found that as his taste in wine evolved, they sort of tracked his character as his character evolved from his early 20s until his early 80s.
In what way? What was he like in his early 20s, and how did you see this pattern work?
Well, he was a country planter with a, who lived on the frontier, the far western reaches of a colonial America.
Uh-huh.
Then when he was appointed ambassador to Paris, where he spent 5 years, he evolved a lot. That was under Louis the 16th. Then he returned and held all these different public offices. And all throughout that time, he was exposed to a lot of interesting people. And every wine available in the world at that time, Jefferson knew.
You have to start out being someone who was intensely curious to be open to all of that.
Oh, he was, I always say if he were in school in America now, they'd be medicating him for being hyperactive. He was just absolutely compulsive about everything, and wine was like architecture or gardening, one of his very favorite subjects.
You know, I'm trying to think of the context. What were people drinking in the colonies as he was growing up?
Fortunately, the Colonial Williamsburg Society was good enough to give me lists from a dozen or so counties from his time.
Mm-hmm.
They were drinking Rhine wine from Germany, claret from Bordeaux, a little bit of Virginia wine, wine from the Azores, Madeira from Portugal. They had a wide variety of wines.
So wine had already had a place in the Americas at that time, or in the colonies?
Oh, definitely. Of course, they had problems getting it. In order to preserve it, they often added sugar and brandy as preservatives. But as he evolved, he started drinking drier and lighter wines, and he learned how to keep them and to get the best and serve the best.
The people, I mean, obviously the people who could afford to drink these wines were wealthy people. What were the people who didn't have money drinking?
Well, even Jefferson at first relied on homemade hard cider. Mm-hmm. He insisted on the particular mm-hmm. varieties of apples and home-brewed beer, which he claimed his was better than the vapid, meager products of Richmond. So they relied on that. But he was always a proponent of good, cheap wine for everyone. Hamilton said wine was a luxury item for the rich, but Jefferson said, no, this is what we should all be drinking to protect us from the bane of whiskey.
That's interesting, because people did drink a lot of hard spirits.
Right. There was probably more obesity and drunkenness in early America than there is now, even. And Jefferson would be proud to see how so many people now are drinking wines, especially American-made wines.
Now, he was famous for his agricultural experiments. Did he ever try to make wine?
He did, but he never got that far because his grapevines always died, either from frost. The 18th century did not have global warming. It was a cold century.
Mm-hmm.
And also vine diseases. He grafted all of his fruit trees, his apricots, his peaches, his apples, but he never thought to graft his grapevines, which if he had grafted European shoots onto American roots, he might have succeeded. But as it was, he didn't succeed in having enough grapes to make wine.
Oh, that's so unfortunate. You would think someone with his agricultural knowledge that he would have come across that.
Well, he'd be happy now because they've restored his vineyards at Monticello, replanted all the grape types he had, and have a wonderful winemaker, Gabriele Rossi, who makes wines, and particularly Sangiovese, that's very good. So Jefferson would be proud that our people of our time have come back and done what he wanted.
Exactly. What were his main loves? What were the wines he really, really loved?
Well, it's become somewhat known that he ordered a lot of red Bordeaux or claret.
Mm-hmm.
But when you check his records in detail over the years, a lot of those famous wines he sent to Washington or he gave to people as gifts, a lot of them to George Washington. But the Burgundies he bought, both red and white, he always sent to Monticello for himself. So I tend to believe that he probably liked Burgundy the best.
So when you were at table with him, would he be serving the wines he really loved, or would he be serving wines that might have been slightly lesser quality?
He always picked his company carefully. He would invite people with similar interests and similar tastes, and he would have a buffet covered with bottles, and people could choose their own.
Huh.
One of his sayings was, at my table, you drink as you please and converse at your ease.
Did he write a lot about his attitudes about, you know, dining and food?
Well, in his lifetime, he wrote over 18,000 letters.
Oh, boy.
And hundreds were totally about wine. When Monroe was elected president, Jefferson wrote him like a 17-page letter, and all but one paragraph was about wine.
Advice to the new president. Tell him what to serve. Advice to the new president. You know, you want to remember this and this about the minister. Now let's get down to the serious stuff.
Exactly, yeah. He practiced champagne diplomacy, they called it.
I love it. I love it. John, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. Thanks very much.
Writer John Hillman is author of Jefferson on Wine. Now, I want to leave you with a recipe I know Thomas Jefferson would fully approve of. It's for lamb with red wine and black olives, and you're going to find it on the website, splendidtable.org. When that first flush of married love is going full tilt, nothing comes close. You're brimming over with desire to treat the beloved as the most cherished being on earth. Bringing joy is all. Until money enters the picture, and then certain gustatory prejudices. Reporter and newlywed Renee Goutel and her husband John Tynan have a story for us.
I just wanted to make breakfast for Renee. I wanted to surprise her. It was 5 in the morning, and it was cold out.
Isn't it romantic?
We had no food in the house, and I just wanted to get pancake mix and maybe some bacon. So I thought, I'll just stop at the end of the block at the Friendly Mart.
I was asleep the whole time. I just had no idea. I was in dreamland.
I pull up to the side of the Friendly Mart. I just kind of ease right in, and I looked around the store, and I looked for bacon, and it was too expensive. It was like $4.99 for a thing of bacon. I was like, well, I don't know. That seems a lot of money.
What I do remember is the alarm going off. And he comes in and turns off the alarm clock, and he says, hey, I've made breakfast for you. We got pancakes. And I said, oh, great. And he said, yeah, and I went to the store, and I got Spam. He goofs around a lot. He's a joker. So I just completely thought he was kidding.
And she says, you're kidding, right? And it was it was right in there. I was just like, oh no. And she's like, oh no, that's okay. Sure, I guess. Fry it up.
And then I realized, okay, you have to take this seriously, Renee. There actually is Spam in your house right now, and you're going to be called upon to eat it shortly. What are you going to do?
I go back into the kitchen, you know, and then I open up the can, and I'm not feeling that great about it. I'm like, oh, well, just open it up, and I'll make it anyway. I guess I have to make a mistake sometime. But I try real hard. I slice them thin, and I try and cook them to their crisp.
He cooked it, he fried it right up, just like you would eat bacon, and I stumbled out and I had it for breakfast, and it wasn't that bad. It was kind of dense, but it was salty. I like salty things. I ate it, a slice or two.
You ever see that Charlie Chaplin silent movie where they eat a shoe? It was kind of like that. You know, it was a salted sole of shoe.
Red flags go up in your head when you're looking at this Spam thinking, I'm about to buy this?
Well, yeah, you know. I felt bad, kind of quibbling in my mind over just a couple bucks.
How much was the Spam?
I was about, it was about $2.50 for the thing of Spam, which was, you know, reasonable. That's what I wanted to pay for bacon.
It did sort of shed light on a very subtle difference between him and me, because I just wouldn't buy Spam, and he would. Maybe every couple there's a Spam dichotomy between the two of them that they don't even know about.
So my penance was 15 Hail Spams. That was going to be my act of contrition. Whatever a Hail Spam is.
Could you try one right now?
Hail Spam, full of grace, the pork is with thee.
Renee Gutel is a reporter at KJZZ in Phoenix, where she lives with her husband, John Tynan. Renee says John really is a great cook. Now, I feel compelled to offer a conciliatory recipe for couples. What could be more unifying than a nice bowl of penne pasta with a sofrito of tomatoes and fresh herbs? You're going to find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And do let us know if we've saved your marriage, okay? Time to play Stump the Cook, the Splendid Table Refrigerator game. Now, here's how it works. A listener calls in with five things that's in the refrigerator, nothing with green fuzz on it or anything shriveled, please. And then I have to come up with a dish with those five ingredients that the caller would really eat. Now, the other judge is our celebrity stump master, Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated Magazine and that hunky TV star and host of PBS's America's
Test Kitchen. Did you say chunky or hunky?
I said hunky.
Okay.
I said hunky. I am buttering you up officially, sir.
It's not going to help. You still have to do a good job, Lynn. We have Brian on the line. Brian, say hello.
How's it going?
Good. And where are you calling from?
I'm calling from York, South Carolina.
And you know what your public radio station is?
WFAE 90.7 in Charlotte.
Oh, these, I have to tell you, these people led me to some of the best fried chicken I've ever put in my mouth. Of course, we should be asking you, I mean, what Christopher really wants to know is your PBS station, and of course, you watch America's Test Kitchen.
Thank
we
you.
Know this.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Still not going to help, Lynn.
I'm trying.
Okay, so Lynn gets salt, pepper, and water. I like that.
Yeah.
And one kind of fat.
Mm-hmm.
And now, what do you have? What are the five
and
things you have?
And three ingredients.
And three other ingredients.
That you really have to have in your kitchen.
So let's get started, Brian. What are your five ingredients?
Okay, my five ingredients are bone-in, thick-cut pork chops.
Oh, you're the kind of guy I used to like to date.
Second is a bottle of salad dressing / marinade that my wife bought. It's a ginger salad dressing.
Okay.
Cran raspberry juice.
If you're heading to cappuccino yogurt, it's over between us right now. Go ahead. All right. Number four.
Vermont white cheddar.
Oh, there you go. My home state.
Uh-huh.
My wife has quite the fondness for white cheddar. As she says, no cow ever gave yellow milk, so any cheese has to be white.
I like your wife. last item.
Half and half.
Pork, dairy, and salad dressing. This is a good one.
What kind of vegetables have you got handy?
Oh, actually, I just went shopping the other day for fresh veggies.
Any cabbage or anything in the cabbage family?
Not really with cabbage.
Any dark greens?
Yes, there's a bag of a spring mix, several bell peppers, white, purple, red, yellow, and green.
Okay, all right. I'm going to take your spring greens. I'm going to take your peppers, okay, the yellow, the whatever, and the whatever. That's all one ingredient.
Okay.
And then I think what I want here is onions. Have you got onions?
Yes, I do have onions.
Okay.
This is going to be good.
He's smiling. He's closing in. It's like this guy is ready to just, you know, pin it down.
The hyenas are circling.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Crashing on the tree branch.
Absolutely.
olive oil.
Yes, I do have extra virgin and straight-up plain olive oil.
Okay, here's what we're going to do. You're going to take the salad dressing, no surprise. You're going to pour that over the pork chops, and you're going to just put that aside.
Okay.
Okay, and you're going to let them marinate. And by the way, you're going to throw about a quarter cup or a half cup of the cran raspberry juice in there.
Okay.
Because that can't hurt. The pork is going to be okay with that. And he's shaking his head. You see, he's prejudging. I mean, the man has no sense.
Cran raspberry
no sense of
juice
justice.
And marinade. Okay.
Yeah, all right. Hey, you got to use it, right? All right. Now you're going to take a big skillet, all right, and ooh, no better. I've got a much better idea. Scathingly brilliant idea. Turn your oven on to 400.
If you say so yourself.
Yeah, turn the oven on to 450. Do you have a big shallow pan?
I do.
Okay. You're going to take chopped up peppers. You want them in about 1-inch pieces. The spring mix, okay, and one or two onions that you're going to cut into slivers, and salt and pepper, and you're going to toss that together, all right?
And you're going to put that in the oven. You're going to roast it about 30 or 40 minutes until the peppers are sweet and the onions are sweet and the greens are almost browned. You get a bitter, sweet tang out of those greens when you do that. Meanwhile, you are going to
I'm getting kind of a bittersweet tang about this recipe, but go ahead.
All right. Meanwhile, you're going to warm the half and half, about a cup of it, and you're going to stir into it about a half a cup of the shredded cheddar.
Okay.
All right. Now, you're going to take those greens and you're going to put those on a big, shallow platter, and you are going to then drain those pork chops and do a slow grill on the grill, all right? And you know what I mean, okay?
Yes.
Because by the time they're done all the way through, you want them very juicy and tender, which means you're going to cook them slow, but you're going to, with all the sugar that's going to be in that cran raspberry juice, and there's probably some in the ginger dressing, you're going to end up getting a really crusty exterior, and you'll have just that hint of sweetness and ginger with it. So now you've got the bitterness of the greens, the sweetness of the pepper and the onions, and you're going to then drizzle the cheese sauce. Just streak it. You're not going to use it all. Streak it over those roasted greens and peppers. And then on top of that, you're going to put the pork chops. And that is your dish. And it's going to be a beautiful contrast between the lush spikiness of the cheddar.
There she goes.
Yeah, I know.
Folks.
Hey, if you do enough food porn, people will eat anything.
Just drizzle the cheese sauce on your tongue. Don't put it on
All
the
All right.
Green.
I now subject myself to the fairness of the court.
I thought we were going to beat you this time, but you got it. And barely, but you got it. It was the cranberry juice thing. That was a tough one.
Well, you know, two you drops and you're there.
You made it.
Hey, Brian. Thank yes. you. Would you make this, by the way?
Absolutely, I'm going to make this. And I should point out that we had, when you first started out, when you were talking about putting the cran raspberry in as part of the marinade, that was exactly what my thinking was, too, actually. I figured that's where
pork
it was
can take
out.
It. I mean,
really pork can good. Hint of collaboration here.
Well, no, we've never met before, right? We have never met. We have never spoken. But I think about if you can do Coca-Cola ham.
Which is actually very good.
Exactly. Yeah. You could do cranberry raspberry juice.
This is like Dr. Pepper pork. There you go. Thanks, Brian. Thanks
for Brian,
playing.
Thank you for playing.
Thank you.
Score one from my side.
No, okay.
Chris, thank you.
My great pleasure. Even though you won.
Our guest celebrity stumpmaster is Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated magazine and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Now, if you want to challenge me and stump the cook, you give us a call, 800-537-5252, and one of our secretive producers may call you to be on the air. Okay. Time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question comes from a recent news report. Here it is. What herb is valuable enough to be stolen even though it smells like cat pee? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted, American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what herb is valuable enough to be stolen even though it smells like cat pee? Well, the herb is buku. It grows wild in South Africa. It's a 3-foot bush with white flowers, and it's become valuable enough to draw thieves. You could just lean over a farmer's fence and swipe a bag full, and you'd get $135 as payback. Now, what's strange about its value is that buku smells like a litter box. Yet French perfumers use the plant's oils, the plant's medicinal properties have built a small industry, and soft drink makers use it to heighten the taste of fruit flavors. Now, all this was in an article from Reuters. Half of Europe is after buku. And if the thieves can be held off, South African farmers will really profit. So what do you want to bet that there's going to be an odd-smelling Buku-enhanced water coming to your local supermarket soon?
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just
pick up that phone. The number is 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the line. We have Mac on the line, who describes himself as a citizen of the world. I'm intrigued, Mac. Tell me about being a citizen of the world.
Well, actually, Lynn, we've met. We ran a trout farm in Star Prairie, Wisconsin, just outside the Twin Cities.
It's Mac and Marcy.
Yes,
I heard you were going to call. Guys, I should explain. Mac and Marcy ran Star Prairie Trout Farm, which was very near where I live out in Wisconsin, supplied restaurants, shops, farmers markets with dynamite trout, gave great parties for all the food types in the area where we'd all come and cook and share and fish for trout. And now I understand you guys have sold everything and you're roaming the country in a trailer?
It's really kind of a two-part story. One, from our farm background and all the farm markets and stuff, we've had this fascination with fresh, local, regionally available, limited accessibility kinds of unique foods.
Right.
Plus, there's this incredible subculture of people who are doing sort of what we're doing, sort of being citizens of the country, if not the world, and not having a fixed address, and traveling around, spending their retirement or whatever it is in a way that's as free of constraints and mortgages and paperwork as is possible. And it's delightful.
So you have a trailer that you're towing, and you stop wherever you want to stop and set up camp.
Every day is a new adventure. We break down and head out. We'll stay a while in a place if it's got some great opportunities, and we end up being great restaurant goers. We just don't do it as much as we used to because we'll be parked in a place that's got incredible scenic vistas. We'll be surrounded by just the coolest local and very fresh ingredients, and we'll just cook our own stuff.
So what kinds of things have you found?
Everywhere we go, we find new things. You know, we actually started on the Gulf Coast in Texas trying to just get warm, leaving the blizzards of northern Wisconsin. And we'd go to open-air fish markets on the wharves and mostly shrimp down there. The Pinea zanadea or whatever, the white shrimp of the Gulf that are tremendous. And they'll clean them for you at no charge. I charge you live weight, of course, and if they come up with a flounder or a pompano in the nets, then, well, generally they won't clean it for you, so you got to have a sharp knife.
Right, right, right. Now, are you actually cooking over a campfire?
Yes, well, and that's really kind of one of the few stipulations we really try to stick to in defining this rustic simplicity we're trying to preserve. We like raw foods, and we like open-fire cookery.
Now, where are you right now?
We are currently in Southern California. We actually spent a month in Arizona, and we're gradually working our way north now that the weather is warming, and we'll experience spring and harvests of local farm products at a time when, in our old haunts, the people are just beginning to think about tillage.
That's right. Well, Mac, this is what, if you would call in periodically and maybe tell us about what you're finding and what you're cooking and about the festivals, we'd love to hear about it.
Well, we would love to do it.
Hey, Mac, thank you, and we'll talk again. You can call us, 800-537-5252. We have Deanna on the line from Pittsburgh. Hey, Deanna, what do you want to talk about?
Well, before I get to my question about cutting boards, I want to tell you that I absolutely love weeknight kitchen recipes.
Oh, thank you.
They have been handy, they've been quick, they've been extremely flavorful, and a variety of things that I wouldn't necessarily have tried if I didn't get those emails.
Did you get the check that I sent you to say that yet, or do you? It's in the mail.
Okay.
No, thanks. We really, it's something that, you know, it's the way we cook every night, and it's practical, if nothing else. But did you have a question?
I did. I was shopping the other day in my grocery store, and I saw these beautiful bamboo cutting boards. And, you know, I was drawn to them. They aren't expensive. They're a sustainable resource, and I was calling to find out what you think of them, how they measure up to the other cutting boards.
Mm. I haven't worked with one. I've played with them, you know, in the sense I was at someone's home that had some, and I just, you know, took a knife and started to see what they felt like. From what I understand from the one person I know who has one, easy to take care of. You know, you can wash it. You know, obviously, you don't put wood in the dishwasher, but I mean, it's easy to very easy to keep clean, etc. But one of the things I found was, I wonder if it's rough on the knives because it's a very hard surface, and you know, the harder the surface, the rougher it is on your knives and also on your wrists. You know those cutting boards that are plastic? They almost look like glass.
Yes.
They are, first of all, the noise they make is enough to make you insane. But
I'm cringing just thinking about
it. I know. I have no idea why anybody would ever buy one. They are the worst. But also, they dull your knives in 4 seconds. And it really does a lot of harm to your hands and your wrists if you work in the kitchen a lot. Because you want a board with a little give. And I think that the bamboo is just this side of perhaps not having as much give as other wooden cutting boards, the maple boards, which are very hard. But you know what I would do? They're inexpensive. Buy one. Try it out for yourself and see what you think. Because you're not talking about something that you're spending $50 on.
And perhaps they just look pretty.
but they are a renewable resource, and they are something that makes a lot of sense from an ecological point of view. And I'd say give it a test run.
And I hadn't thought about the knife thing. I was just wondering about the food safety.
Oh, I don't think that would be a problem. And any cutting board that you work with, you want to wash it with hot soapy water. And I always keep a little bleach water around. It's just about a tablespoon of bleach for a quart of water. I put it in an old spray bottle. And what I do is I finish with the board. I put it in the sink. I spray that on. I forget about it for, you know, 5 minutes or 10 minutes, or, you know, a minute even. And then I wash it with hot soapy water and I dry it immediately.
Okay.
And that's the way you really take care. You make sure your board is always sanitary. And do that with everything. If you have plastic, obviously, you can put that in the dishwasher as well.
Right.
And also, from the sanitary point of view, you know the old business of you have one board that you allot for all animal proteins and then another board for all the other stuff. So you keep that separate. But I would, you know what, try one. Now you've got me thinking I'm going to go out and get one and try it. I have every cutting board known to man right now. I might as well try bamboo, for goodness sake.
You know, why not?
Exactly.
Or, you know, continue the collection. So. Thank you.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
You can call us 800-537-5252. We have Chris calling from Seattle. Chris, what do you want to talk about?
You know, I really like sauerkraut. And I've always, there's some German places here in Seattle sell it, and I was wondering how it's made exactly.
Well, the first thing you probably need is a container that's not going to react with a brine, because, you know, I mean, you know, you think about this, salt water, think about it, that can eat into car bumpers.
Yeah.
And that's why I think people use heavy glazed pottery, glass.
Oh, yeah. Okay,
you see
glass.
What I'm saying? So you want something deep. And generally what it's a case of is that you are thin slicing a lot of cabbage and you're making layers of cabbage with a little bit of salt on them, another layer of cabbage with a little bit of salt, another layer with a little bit of salt. And or you are taking that salt and putting it into boiling water to dissolve it.
Oh, then you put the water in
Yes, and you cool the water completely. You can do it either way. But the idea is that you have the layering of the salt and the cabbage must be entirely submerged. You add enough water to entirely submerge it, and you put it in a cool place. And what's going to happen is it's actually going to start to ferment. And you
That's
can
what I thought.
Yeah,
it's,
you smell it actually beginning to happen. And you might even see some bubbling. Some of the old recipes tell you to pick up the foam from that. Some people will add to that mix caraway seeds or whole cloves or bay leaves. But the basic thing is it's salt and water. But it's going to be a matter of 3 or 4 weeks or more.
Oh.
Yeah. And the thing that I'm always leery about is that you want to keep things at a safe temperature. You want to play to the side of safety. And so that's where I say keep it in a place where, you know, it's cool. So it's about 33 degrees, just to be on the safe side.
Right.
So it may slow down the fermentation slightly. But remember, this has always been made in the winter.
Right. And you're going to eat it.
So you're going to eat it. Safe. Yeah. So you really want to make sure. But the fermentation process will calm down. And, of course, the cabbage will be entirely wilted. And when it calms down, you stop smelling something that's yeasty and that kind of thing and gaseous. And that's
So you wait through that period.
Yeah, exactly. So you're going to need 3-4 weeks or so, and then you've got sauerkraut.
Okay.
Hey, go and have fun and let us know how it turns out.
I will.
All right.
Thanks very much, Chris.
Goodbye.
Right, bye.
Making sauerkraut. I love it. You can do pickles, by the way, a very similar way. Anyway, you can call us 800-537-5252. Well, marketing research finally goes where only the moody frequent dieter has gone before. The January 2007 issue of the Journal of Marketing featured several studies about how our moods affect what we eat. Well, one of the authors of the studies is Nitika Garg. Now, she's assistant professor of marketing at the University of Mississippi. Nitika, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be there.
Well, Nitika, the first study that you did was about movies and popcorn. Now, how did this work?
Basically, we got people in, and this was done in a lab. But, we set up a room very realistically with a couch and a TV and everything. And we got about 5-7 people at a time, and we made them watch either Love Story or Sweet Home Alabama. Now, Love Story was to induce a sad mood.
Right.
And Sweet Home Alabama was to induce a happy mood. And what we found was that, amazingly, people in a sad mood, they chow down more on the popcorn than those in the happy mood.
So the sad love story produces more, at least more emotional hunger, probably.
Right. It's just that sad people, they're looking for a reward. They have this feeling of sense of loss, and they want to get out of that feeling. Obviously, it's not a nice one, right?
Right.
And so they're looking for ways to repair their mood state. And eating something which is, pleasurable, which is tasty, is just one of those ways.
Now, you did a second study. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. In the second study, our objective was to, not only test this in a more controlled setting so that we could claim that, sad mood do indeed cause people to eat more. But we also wanted to test for the effect of nutritional information. And that is, if we show people how bad something is for you, we don't say it, but if we just show them the nutritional information,
mm-hmm.
does it make a difference? And what we found was that reassuringly it does. So when people see nutritional information, they are less likely to binge on unhealthy food products than if they didn't see it.
So if you show me that label that tells me this is going to be healthier than the second label, the second food, I'm going to consciously make a choice to eat healthier.
That's tricky. In the third study, we did test for that. And what we find is that happy people inherently tend towards healthier food products, whereas sad people don't. So it's not really clear whether if we show them nutritional information on healthy versus unhealthy, they would automatically go towards healthy, but maybe they look for alternative ways to, repair their mood, to reward themselves.
So do you think that there's special consolation for people when things that are have lots of fat and salt and sugar?
It's interesting. There is research to show that people believe that something which is unhealthy is inherently tasty. And yes, it seems like stuff that's not good for us definitely is appealing.
And hence the fast food industry is probably now going to look for people who are terribly unhappy because they can make more money on them.
Yeah, that would be a strategy, although we do say that, just to keep your consumers happy in the long run, you probably don't want to exploit them when they're down.
Well, that's good to hear. Nitika, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, no problem. Thank you so much.
You take care.
Bye.
Nitika Garg is assistant professor of marketing at the University of Mississippi. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought about food and feeling from Judith Viorst. She said, "When my husband is late for dinner and I know he must either be having an affair or lying dead in the street, I always hope he's dead." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board. Handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. You'll find newsletters and podcasts of all stripes available for free, including our newest seasonal offering, How to Eat Supper, based on our new book, well, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. So be sure to check it all out at splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is brought to you in part by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness. Online at loveandforgive.org. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Andrew Schumacher. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.